in here. Is that Kelly for this?
Yes.
Affliction,
so I've, yes, I've just prepared a one-page sort of summary of the legal submissions, just to set the scene. Introduce the team. So after myself, the order that we'll proceed in is we'll start with Ms. Rowe on the transport chapter, followed by Mr. Henderson on earthworks, followed by Mr. Ferguson on signs and visitor accommodation. So in terms of the decision-making framework, as with Stream 14, we replaced reliance on the case law that emphasises the least restrictive regime that gives effect to the higher order documents meets the purpose of the Act should be adopted in order to give proper weight to the benefits and costs under Section 32 and best enable well-being. And that case law is cited in the legal submissions. With respect to Chapter 29, the key areas of difference relate to the high traffic generating activity rule as it relates to Jack's Point Zone and parking for ski area activities outside of the ski area subzones. In respect of the high traffic generating rule, Ms. Rowe's expert opinion is that it is appropriate for the currently permitted and controlled land use and subdivision rules to be exempt. This is because they are more appropriate in light of the NPSUDC, the ORPS and the PRPS, as well as the higher order chapters 3 and 4, as they avoid unnecessary constraint on house capacity otherwise enabled and provided for in the Jack's Point zone, which is within the urban growth boundary, while still ensuring that there is the ability to address effects on the transport network. The zone has been structure planned as a level of development that is known, anticipated, and should be being planned for through development contributions, and already provides for consideration of the types of matters set out in the High Traffic Generating Rule in Chapters 41 and 27. The bespoke provisions and framework is already in place to cater for the predicted and anticipated transport needs of the Jack's Point community between the RMA and LGA frameworks. And for Council to now take a position that those provisions are insufficient after all these years is surprising and contrary to all the decisions made to date since the inception of the zone, including in Stage 1 or Chapters 27 and 41. And it results in a level of double dipping, so I endorse the legal submissions from RCL on that point in particular. In respect of parking for ski area activities outside of the ski area subzone and transportation requirements of the ski area subzone particularly, the submitters seek a new policy and seek an exclusion to Rule 29.4.11. In respect of earthworks, the key points of concern are recognising the benefits of earthworks to the continued operation and development of the ski area subzones, duplication with the Otago Regional Plan water, and the lack of justification or evidence for increased controls over earthworks in the ski area subzones just 2 years after a comprehensive plan change 49 Chapter 22 of the ODP explicitly found exemptions were justified. The primary concern in respect of visitor accommodation for these submitters is the effect of the rules supported by Council on Jack's Point Village in particular, which is a specific activity area within the Jack's Point zone. Given its explicit purpose as a mixed-use hub, including for visitor accommodation, and the eventual controls that will be provided through some form of comprehensive development stage, it is unnecessary and unjustified duplication to then add another layer of consenting requirements for homestays and RVAs. Mr. Ferguson is of the expert opinion that no rules or standards for homestays and RVAs are necessary within the village, given the other controls that are present and the intended use of the village activity area already approved. Similarly, for signage in the village, there is sufficient control already in place. And finally, Jack's Point also seeks that the council-owned reserve in the zone remain part of the Jack's Point Zone OSA activity area rather than the less integrated informal recreation zone that does not fit as well within the overall structure plan in Chapter 41.
I've got a few questions regarding your submissions on the earthworks and ski area subzones.
Okay.
I'm just
If the questions of detail, I'll probably defer to Ms. Rowe in terms of the mechanics of the plan.
No.
No,
I understand the mechanics of the plan.
Good, excellent.
Just looking at your overall, and you're saying benefits have to be taken into account, are you submitting that the benefits of an activity should override any adverse effects on the environment?
No, we're submitting that there's, at the moment, not an explicit acknowledgement of the benefits of earthworks in the context of scarier subzones. So it's
so
about...
Who are the benefits for?
For the maintenance and expansion of the zones, they're a significant asset to the district, and a lot of people use them to recreate and get benefit from. So it's in that context that earthworks are a critical part of enabling that resource, if you like, to be maintained and appropriately expanded.
But subdivisions are a critical part of the development of the district, don't they?
Yes.
And they have controls on earthworks, don't they?
Yes.
So what's the difference?
Well, often those controls on earthworks, I think, you guys jump in if I'm wrong, because this is getting into a matter of detail, is captured under the actual subdivision consent application rather than the earthworks rules. It's all tied in at that stage.
But irrespective of which way they are, there are controls on earthworks, aren't there?
Yes.
Now, what evidence have you provided that earthworks in the ski area subzones has no effect on the environment?
No specific evidence.
So what are we supposed to rely on?
Well, that's why we've cited the decision on Plan Change 49, which did reference the evidence and the submissions from the ski area operators that it was an appropriate exemption to make.
I've read that decision, and I think that your selective quotes from it are rather misleading, to put it bluntly.
Right.
You didn't quote the part of the submission that stated that the purpose of Plan Change 49, which is in Section 3 on page 5, was to simplify and streamline the earthworks provisions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is a different purpose from what is proposed in Chapter 25, isn't it?
I'll consider that comment.
The other thing is, when you read the decision, what you omitted to include in your quotes was that in the reply evidence, the council officer agreed with the submitters.
Yes.
Therefore, the commissioner had no contrary evidence to come to any conclusion on that.
I'll consider that comment as well.
Well, it's straightforward, isn't it? I mean, you can only make a decision based on the evidence, and if all the evidence goes one way, you can't make a contrary decision, can you?
No. And that's also the situation in this instance where we've said consistently there's been no evidence from the council as to what the change in adverse effects from earthworks and the scarier subzones to justify a change in position from where Plan Change 49 landed.
I think there has been evidence on that. The evidence has been that the proposal is not to stop earthworks, but to ensure that they are managed in a way that ensures there are no adverse effects off the sites involved. Now, you haven't provided any evidence that there are no adverse effects off the sites involved, the ski area subzones. We've got no idea what earthworks are proposed. You make it sound like there's billions of cubic metres moved every year, and that there's a need for that. Although, to be fair, having skied at Cadrona for 10 years, they didn't change the runs very much year to year. So the earthworks were not monstrous in terms of that ski area subzone. I don't know about triple cutting. What are we dealing with here?
There's a simple lack of justification from the council in the increase in restrictions placed in these areas.
Is that your position?
That's our principal position.
Right.
Because I just interrupt here? Because, I mean, there is an exemption for ski area subzones. They're exempt from quite a lot of the rules, aren't they? They're exempt from the area, the volume, for example, and area rules.
Yeah.
I mean, the ones that your client has not, and that the officers haven't suggested exempting your client from, your client's ski areas, relate to things like sediment entering waterways,
yes,
and dust leaving dust nuisance. I mean, why shouldn't a ski area, I mean, what's the evidence to say that a ski area should be able to put sediment into waterways or create dust nuisances without any oversight from the council?
With regards to sediment, that's one of the areas where there's duplication between the regional plan water and the...
Yeah, well, I'll ask about the evidence on that.
So that's your
position, is that the ORC adequately covers those methods?
Yeah, it has rules that address sedimentation or clarity.
Dust.
I wasn't aware we were seeking a different position as to dust.
Dust is a standard, yes.
Yeah, you're not wanting the dust controls to apply. You're not wanting... I mean, it seems to me that the controls that your client is seeking to be exempt from are fairly standard controls that anyone should be able to achieve. And as the chairman said, it's sort of a bit of a straw man.
Right. Well, yeah.
I mean,
it's not intended to be a straw man. We're simply not convinced that there's been any justification for the change in position, particularly in light of the duplication with ORC's current regime.
So, but are you saying there's no justification, but you're not saying there's a legal bar to a council reviewing?
There's not a legal bar.
Something that's happened relatively recently.
No, there's no legal bar to it, but there needs to be reasons for a change.
And you understand about the review that the council's had done of an audit that's been done of earthworks generally, maybe not on Speedfield, but generally across the district there's been an audit done of the sorts of controls on earthworks and whether they meet best practice, and the audit says they've come up, dismally failing to meet best practice across New Zealand. So are you saying that we should take no notice of that sort of information and just continue with the Plan Change 49 approach?
Was it a national review?
No, it's district-wide.
Sorry, district-wide. No, that's relevant information for you to evaluate.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just on the duplication issue, what regional rules control land use in ski area subzones?
They don't control land use, it's the water discharge rules, water quality rules, in terms of sedimentation.
And how do they work?
Well, that's where I'll defer to Mr. Henson, who has addressed the duplication of the rules in his evidence.
And there isn't any evidence in his rules of effectiveness in this district, is there?
I don't think it would be appropriate for there to be an evaluation overall of ORC's implementation of its plan.
Why
the fact is that the provisions are, because you have to assume that they will apply their plan.
Yes, but the point that the council has made is that there is a distinct difference between controlling the land use and the effect that may have on water quality, which is a requirement under the MPS for freshwater management that applies to this council,
yes,
as well as regional councils, you've read.
Yes.
And a rule which controls a discharge which may be having an effect.
If it's a land use, though, that results in a discharge that has that same effect, there's no reason that the water plan cannot be implemented to control that resultant discharge and effect. It's otherwise a duplication.
What if there's a temporal period between the land use and the discharge?
A temporal period?
Yes. I mean, if you do the earthworks in January, and in May, as the result of rainstorms, there's a discharge. Or a landslide. How does the regional council's rules fix that.
No, that's a scenario that we haven't considered.
Isn't that a distinct possibility when you're at the very top of the catchment, working with rock and shingle and loess, which isn't held down by much vegetation?
It may be. We'd have to go back and look at the wording of the regional council's rules.
Well, the regional council doesn't control the land use, though, does it?
No, it controls discharges at the point of discharge.
And isn't it an engineering problem in terms of the actual earthworks themselves that would need to be dealt with when the earthworks were done to ensure that sort of occurrence didn't happen?
That's something to look at.
I mean, this is exactly the point that the technical audit and the evidence based on that has raised with us, is that the regional council's rules are sort of after the event. I mean, it's an enforcement action or something, and hoping that that will deter people from allowing it to happen again in the future, but it's not a proactive management of the land use in a best practice way.
Right.
To ensure that that doesn't happen at all.
Right.
Yeah. Which is perfectly normal practice in most parts of the world, in New Zealand.
Yeah.
I mean, you say, one of the things you say, that there are many unique factors relating to earthworks in the ski area zones. And then the only example you give, and I know you're not really giving evidence, is about that there might be some water bodies to do with snowmaking. Well, they may be able to be exempt if they're a non-natural waterway that's somehow caught up in these rules. But I mean, what are the differences, and maybe your witnesses can answer this, about between a subdivision, which might open up a whole lot of land at one time, versus a ski area opening up a whole lot of, doing a whole lot of earthworks for terrain management? What is actually unique about these areas?
Well, their role in the district's economy, their location sort of quite separate from and separated from populations, residences.
But not separated from water bodies.
No, not necessarily. Yep.
And as Chairman said, I mean, are they more important than subdivision for housing and development?
Well, they're completely different in terms of their role in this district's economy, the role that tourism plays in the Queensland district and the four ski areas' role in that is quite different to a subdivision.
But you did agree with me that the benefits from the overriding environmental effects.
No, I agree about that, but I also made the point that the weight, there's not apparent yet in the provisions that the appropriate weight has been given to the benefits of the mainland ski areas to maintain themselves and develop with their groups.
Well, we can ask the witness about the policy project.
I'm just unsure, though, legally, how you see that weight applying. If the purpose of the rules is to ensure good management, are you suggesting that the benefit should enable poor management?
No.
So how does that weight apply? If think about it, if there's a consent officer has an application in front of them for some earthworks, and the purpose is to ensure good management of the earthworks, rather than stopping them. That's not the point, is to ensure good management. What assistance does it give that consenting officer to know that there's some benefit? I mean, surely everyone doing earthworks is deriving benefits from doing it.
Well, if it's a restricted discretionary rule and the benefits aren't explicitly recognised as a matter of discretion, or if it is, but there's not a corresponding policy that sharpens the focus on what that means, then it is possible that a planning officer may not give appropriate weight to the benefits that will be derived from that development.
But what is the weight going to do? That's what I'm trying to get you to explain to me. What is the weight that they give to it going to do? Is it going to say, oh, it's okay, it doesn't matter if that is not stabilised? Is that what you're suggesting?
No.
Well, I'm just having difficulty understanding what those benefits is, as a matter of discretion are supposed to do. You know, is it, if there's no benefits, you say no. That might be a thing, but it seems to me that that's not the purpose of the Act either.
It's a broad concern that on this particular point, that where if an RD rule is applied in a way that the case law currently requires you to apply it, which is that only the matters of discretion listed can be considered, if it's not recognised and if there's not an appropriate policy where that rule fits, it can leave some processing planners getting off in the wrong direction, which is, you know, people's experience. So it's to ensure that if it is in an RD framework...
We have to. You just told me not more than 3 or 4 minutes ago that we have to work on the basis that the plan will be operated and enforced properly.
Yes, which is why we are trying to ensure that it's, there's a policy that fits and that drives the decision-making in the appropriate way.
But I still don't see how even acknowledging benefits will make a difference. You haven't explained that to me.
That's as far as I can take it today. As you know, I'm coming back tomorrow with another ski area. Well, similar submissions, but different witnesses. And Mr. Barnes, whose evidence from stage one we've appended, will be present, and he has got operational experience, as has Ms. Black. So maybe those...
I don't think Mr. Barnes or Ms. Black can help me with that, right? I think at best, Mr. Henderson, Mr. Henderson, Mr. Farrell are the three that are going to have to deal with that. I mean, I'm just trying to be realistic about these things. If we're looking at managing something and ensuring there's not an issue, it's really no different from me putting 40 truckloads of fill on my property and ensure that I've got a decent front board, is it? It's a benefit to me, but what was more important was that it didn't fall onto the neighbour's place and it didn't cause a dust problem to the other neighbours. It was irrelevant to the decision making that it was going to be to my benefit, wasn't it?
Yeah, I disagree with that example being helpful because, like I said, one of the features of ski area subzones is their lack of their long way away from people's other people's residences.
Well, that's an effect issue, not a benefits issue.
Yes.
So I don't see that benefits are relevant when considering the distance from the receiving environment. That's an effects issue. A more similar issue might be a large subdivision versus a small subdivision. A large subdivision will have more benefits to the community than a small one. But therefore, they have lesser controls imposed on them than the small one, because there's more benefits. Well, it's essentially what you're asking for, though, isn't it? In the way you're phrasing it?
That wasn't how we thought of it, so no, that's not exactly
that's
what we're asking.
My worry, you see, is that what you're asking for might lead to that outcome.
I'll consider that.
Wouldn't it be more important for the provisions to be explicit that it's about managing the effects of earthworks rather than stopping them?
That's definitely something that the experts will be able to give you their opinion on.
A number of questions on Jack's point, but I just wondered if really, again, seems to be a bit of a non-issue in that the village area needs to, if there's going to be a structural change for it, it needs to go through a way of plan change. And the detailed issues, the jury can be dealt with that way. And most of the other matters you raise seem to be things that would apply to the urban area in general. There's nothing other than the fact that it has its own chapter. Most of Jack's point is nothing uniquely different about it than to distinguish it from another suburb in the district, does it?
Yeah, that's within the urban growth boundary.
Yes,
correct.
And so, really, as long as we have similar outcomes in the residential areas, Jack's point, as we have other residential zones, would be the appropriate way to proceed.
Well, I mean, we're not simply looking for equity. The position is that because there's, you've got the local government ability to impose development contributions that take care of those wider issues that developments contribute to, versus a zone or a suburb that's already been tested and approved and anticipated to be enabled, and that there should not be that overlap that is currently a risk of between both of those frameworks and the ability to provide, to ensure that the wider transport network is keeping pace.
Seem to me that there's an issue that the rule actually only relates to the development of buildings, not subdivisions. Well, 94.10.4.10 talks about subdivision activity exceeding the thresholds. The thresholds actually only refers to residential units. And the question is, do any of the developers in Jack's point develop 50 or more residential units, or anyone in the district for that matter?
So you're looking at 29.6?
29.10. It's on page 29.39.
So sorry, can you please repeat the question, Mr.
Chair? The threshold is 50 residential units. So, are there any developers erecting, building, consenting 50 or more residential units?
There could well be. Yes, it's definitely a possibility. Yeah.
Your clients?
Not right now, but there's a lot of planning afoot. So yes, it's a possibility.
So, but it would only apply in those instances, or in the other ones.
Mm. Yes.
Because I think there is an assumption made by some people that it applies to creation of lots, but I can't find anything in the rules other than mention the subdivision in 29.
In the first rule, yeah.
There's nothing in the thresholds that it says.
But no, there's definitely a lot of planning at the moment about the currently zoned activity areas that could trigger that threshold.
Outside of the village?
Yes.
I didn't think there were any activity areas left outside of the village.
No, there are. Yeah, so Mr. Ferguson might be able to help on that as well, as well as Ms. Ryan. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yes, just a few questions arising from that, and I'm quite aware this is to respond later if they wish to as well. I haven't seen in the evidence this whole issue of what should the ORC be doing and what should the council be doing. Now, I know that with the environment can be planned. So they have specifically set out either in each chapter or in the plans, actually a heading that says district council shall, and it sets out what the regional council and those superior instruments expect district council to do. Now, we can't hear anything about that because that might be quite helpful to us. We know what regional council expects district councils to do in the field of land use, earthworks and related matters. It should specify something. I haven't seen any evidence on that so far.
Right.
It seems to be reasonable. It should be spelled out in some way. Make you feel that we're not just picking on you. We heard from evidence from other parties as well. There's been a bit of a permeation throughout the hearings, which is almost sounds like a post-King Salmon shock type of thing, whereby we had evidence, I think it was from Mr. Dent, who said if you're going to keep the current provisions in the plan relating to earthworks on ski fields, then we want you to add an objective and a range of policies setting out the benefits basically of ski fields and related matters. So it does look to us that what is seeming to be happening is that where a balance situation arises, and we're balancing pros and cons, you end up looking at a situation where you've got a whole lot of objective and policies which are very enabling, which will always outgun provisions designed to provide environmental protection. It seems to be a bit of an element to that. I think that's what the issue of concern the chairman was raising about this kind of thing. It hasn't just happened through your submissions
of
evidence, it's been happening throughout the hearing.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's partly post King Salmon and it's partly if something is going to fall into that RDA framework, I think currently not right case court from the High Court, that's not helpful. Anyway, which if it's an RDA, you can only consider the matters that are listed as a matter of discretion. So while we're in that space, it would be remiss of people to not try and ensure that benefits of activities are appropriately explicitly recognised.
And that's where the balance issue comes in, I suppose.
Yes.
What is appropriate? It may not be a case of saying the council might join beeswax. It's ORC to consider that it may be a broader issue.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Final question was, and I think it might be mentioned very briefly before, is that I know a whole lot of works are undertaken on ski fields. I personally know very little about the sort of things they do on ski fields and it's done in terms of earthworks, but take Drona as an example. I have no idea. We've heard nothing to say, well, Drona will need another 1,000 car parks or it will need to carry out 2 million cubic metres of earthworks over the next 5 years. So we really don't have any sort of picture of the kind of scale of activity we're dealing with here. We know things could happen. We have no idea what the scale of those might be. Might help inform us when we're considering what provisions should go on.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's a bit of a black hole as far as I'm
concerned. Yeah. So we don't have anyone from Triple Cone here, but the Cadrona, the bigger picture Cadrona picture, which also covers Soho, like I say, Mr. Barnes might be able to assist us tomorrow with an idea of that, just to give you a feeling for it anyway.
Okay. Just paragraph 60 of your submissions, you tell us about Mr. Ferguson supporting various amendments. Would deleting rules that provide for something as a permitted activity actually end up making them non-compliant or discretionary?
Mr. Ferguson, think about that one.
What zone was that?
The rural zone.
The rural zone.
And the Waikato Basin, the amenity zone. The other meeting you raised in your summary, just this issue of signs in the gaps village area.
Yes.
There's nothing in Chapter 41 that controls signs in that area, is there?
Not really.
No, because your submission suggests it was already dealt with.
Well, my submission was that through the comprehensive development plan process, that there will be much more detailed controls imposed.
Would it equally be a good policy basis to say that the local shopping centre rules for signs apply there?
Well, in terms of how that would integrate with the zone, I'd have to, again, Mr. Ferguson, how would we think about that question?
No, that's just a thought.
Just one, which was just that lots of the evidence in terms of earthworks and Skiru subzone in relation to that deals with the current situation, whereas we could say that we're on the cusp of a change of use for ski zones, and that they were predominantly ski area subzones, but now you could almost call them recreation area subzones. Mm. So there's a lot more year-round use, and with that comes other developments such as accommodation, VA, blah, blah, blah. So I'm just interested in your opinion on that, and also the validity of looking and reassessing earthworks in that context.
If we're looking at a new era of development within the zones?
Yes. Given that there's a lot of argument saying this has already been covered, we've got this,
Yeah. We
know what we're doing, whereas and you need to prove why we're asking for these changes.
Yeah.
Well, it is such a fluid changing environment, surely, that would that not then give it scope to investigate further regulation?
Right. Go back and look at, again, remind myself of the rules in the scarier subzone for any of that more, you know, that sort of new wave, if you like, of development type levels of control, generally, the matters of discretion, to properly answer that question. So, again, I could probably help you tomorrow on that one.
Look forward to it.
Yeah. Right, so the first witness will be Ms. Rowe. So I've got a one-page summary for Ms. Rowe.
Following the preparation of my evidence in chief, I have reviewed the evidence and rebuttal statements prepared by Vicky Jones and Stuart Crosswell, both dated the 22nd of August 2018. I have also reviewed the statements of evidence prepared by other witnesses that relate to Chapter 29, and this summary is focused on the remaining areas of difference, namely the high traffic generation rule and the parking for ski area activities. Ms. Jones considers that it is appropriate to exempt proposed land use or subdivision from the high traffic generation activities rule where rezoning has been informed by an ITA, and results in rules in the district plan to require works to be undertaken, and where a subdivision or development proposal will have the same or lesser effects on traffic generation as an existing land use or subdivision consent, and is in accordance with the ITA approved as part of that previous consent. The Jack's Point zone was considered in hearings on topic 9. Evidence presented for those proceedings addressed a range of issues, including the anticipated development yields within the zone, the provision of vehicular access from the zone to State Highway 6, and the extent to which provisions to manage traffic effects resulting from the expanded village areas, the education area, and the EIC area were necessary. The panel was provided with evidence on transport matters, considered the appropriateness of additional provisions to manage transport effects from the development of the villages, and determined that they were not necessary. For these reasons, and specifically in relation to the extent that transportation effects have informed the zoning and plan provisions that applies to the Jack's Point zone, my view remains unaltered in that it is appropriate to permit it in controlled land use and subdivision in the Jack's Point zone to be exempt from the high traffic generation activity rule. Having considered Ms. Jones' statement at paragraph 17.2, I agree that both chapters 21 and 29 are relevant when determining the consent triggers and activity status of parking access to and within ski area subzones. This means that parking associated with ski area activities would require consent as a discretionary activity, as ski area activities are not provided for in the table that sets out the minimum parking requirements. I acknowledge that the amendments to the definition of off-site parking by Ms. Jones will have the effect of excluding off-site parking associated with activities undertaken in the ski area subzone from triggering consent as a restricted discretionary activity under Rule 29.47. The operative district plan contains a similar rule to 29.4.11, but it provides an exemption from this catch-all rule for activities that are permitted or controlled in the zone. Amending Rule 29.4.11 to include an exclusion to this effect for parking associated with ski area activities would more appropriately recognise the unique nature and locational characteristics of ski area activities. In my evidence in chief, I propose that an additional policy be inserted into Chapter 29 to recognise the unique transportation requirements of ski area activities to support the above amendment. Ms. Jones does not appear to address that relief in her evidence and rebuttal, and I remain of the view that the insertion of this policy is appropriate. I also have a number of corrections to my evidence in chief. If I could run those through quickly. Firstly, my cover page erroneously refers to the evidence as addressing the visitor accommodation variation, Chapter 38 and Chapter 31. This should instead refer to Chapter 29. Paragraph 9 on page 2 has a missing cross-reference, and this should refer to paragraph 7. There is some missing text at the end of paragraph 18 on page 5, and the missing words are development with the wider infrastructure networks, including transport.
Whereabouts is it?
That's on page 5 and it's paragraph 18.
It's page 18.
Paragraph 18.
Development.
Great. Oh, sorry, yes. So development with the wider infrastructure networks. And then in parentheses, including transport. Last correction on page 12. I set out some amendments to the high traffic generation rule in red font, and I note the words for subdivision in the first line were shown as red and they should be black. They were in the plan as notified.
A number of points throughout the evidence as attention drawn to Jack's Point being unique and therefore needs to be treated differently. An example of that is in the case of keeping traffic generating rules, for example. Basically saying that Jack's Point should be exempted because it's different to other areas, but in other respects, you're saying, like, with respect to parking, it should be treated like existing commercial areas elsewhere in the industry. It does seem to be a little bit of a disjoint there. Is that driven by desire to avoid the negotiation consent processes, or is it really because it is actually different?
No, well, I've turned my mind to, I guess, the extent to which transport and land use planning and the integration of those occur through various processes in development plans and endlessly in setting the provisions of those plans and processing resource consents. So in the case of Jack's Point, the area has been structured planned over the previous 15 years and has been a structured plan has been developed, which has been incorporated into the district plan, as compared to perhaps in other areas of the district where the zoning has evolved over time in perhaps less of a structured plan type approach. So that's where I draw the distinction in terms of the planning and in, land, sorry, planning and transport integration that's informed that process.
Just looking at the Jack's Point Village issue, I seem to recall from Chapter 41, I think we all found ourselves in the most unusual position where we're basically ending up with an area of land which is absolutely colossal, basically, with evidence of establishment to be quite bigger than the entire centre of Queenstown. Now, in terms of land area, now of course there are other restrictions in terms of water space and such like, but in, given those uncertainties that still surround the development of that area, would it be appropriate to have additional regulatory control over that, such as traffic generation and parking, given that the details of that specific area are still pretty much up in the air?
Yes, and I think as I've set out in my evidence, there are a number of provisions in the Jack's Point provisions that do speak to issues such as traffic generation and the management of access to State Highway 6 in particular, and the type of point at which that access should be upgraded in order to cater for that additional demand. And and there's also another a range of other matters that relate to the requirement to connect to active transport networks, provide those connections, and equally with public transport.
And even at a more localised level, given the sheer size of that area, there could be localised health issues that need to be addressed.
Quite possibly. And I also do know the comprehensive development plan process, noting that that is subject to appeal. The mechanism by which that might occur is still undecided. Provides another opportunity to get into that level of detail at a more fine-grained approach.
There's a couple of questions. The matter that you've raised in your summary relating to Rule 29.4.11, mm-hmm. I just want to get my head around that. You're saying that because there's no specific parking requirement for ski areas in Table 29.5 or whatever it is, that automatically, under that rule, 29.4.11, any provision of parking in a ski area would become a full discretionary activity under Chapter 29.
That's my understanding of that rule, yes.
But what does the ski, the rural zone chapter have to say about that? Because, as I understand it, ski area activities are permitted. So
as I understand it, and this is where I had earlier confusion in my evidence in chief between on the relationship between
yes.
the two zone, rules and rules and Chapter 29. So as I understand it, in the ski area, well, in Chapter 21, there's obviously the rural zone generally and the ski area subzones, and ski area activities are permitted within the ski area subzone, but as per the council decision on Chapter 21, are non-complying in the rural zone. There is an appeal seeking that activity status is amended to be a discretionary activity.
So ski area activities would be non-compliant
in the rural zone.
In the rural zone, and that may or may not include parking
and
associated with a ski area, which may be in the adjoining ski area subzone.
Mm. Because another factor at play here is the definition of ski area activities and the extent to which that does or does not anticipate the provision of parking and access. It's, because I set out my evidence in chief, it's not explicitly clear and it could be interpreted one way or the other.
And is that subject to appeal as well?
I'd have to check that.
So one hand you're saying it's there are two potential problems with about parking in the rural zone. One is that it's not clear if the permitted ski area activities would include permitted parking, rather than all of it didn't. But considering like a huge amount of a ski field seems to be parking. But in this subzone that may or may not be part of the permitted activities. And are the situations that could arise where the ski area zone subzone is not big enough or doesn't encompass areas where parking might be provided, say at the bottom of a road or halfway up a road or something like that. That's in the rural general zone. And again, that could possibly be not compliant.
That's the primary concern, is the ski area parking, not in the ski area subzone, because it's technically a ski area activity.
Yeah.
It's under the stage one decision, non-compliant.
That is subject to appeal.
That's subject to appeal.
And to become a discretionary. So that, I mean, that's nothing to do with us. But so what's the problem with the provision, the full discretionary activity provision in the transport zone? Is it how that relates to or is overridden by or not overridden by whatever ends up being to do with the activity of parking relating to spare fields?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of issues. There's firstly the central relationship between the two chapters, and I acknowledge that given the order of proceedings that may or may not be able to be resolved. But similarly, the discretionary activity status that applies to any parking that isn't provided for in minimum parking standards is a higher level of activity than, for example, not providing the minimum parking requirements for an activity that is listed within that chapter. So there's a
sort of a bit odd, like if you're providing lots of parking in the ski area subzone, you may end up being a full discretionary activity. Whereas if you didn't provide any, you might.
Yeah.
And you were in a
and then there's a
urban zone or something, you might only be RDA. All right, okay.
I'm just looking at the Chapter 2 definition of ski area activities and the appeal or the main sort of appeal.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look to me as though it includes parking at all. So.
No, and I think that was the point that I tried to perhaps to make clearly in my evidence, was that it could be interpreted one way or the other. It's not explicit in the definition.
If it's ambiguous, then we need to fix ambiguities, and we can't change Chapter 2.
No.
But we can change Chapter 29. So should we deal with Chapter 29? Because it clearly, it's not even in the relief sought in the appeal to have parking as one of the parts of the activities.
Correct.
So,
I guess in one.
So there are two issues, aren't there? There's what should be the activity status for parking for ski area activities within the ski area subzones, and what should be the activity status for the parking off-site.
And that also brings in this other dimension in Chapter 29 of the distinction between parking generally, accessory parking, non-accessory parking, and off-site parking. And there's various ways in which those are treated within the chapter as well. So in the case of some of the ski area activities, the ski areas, they may comprise a number of sites within a ski area subzone. And providing accessory parking to that activity may be off-site as per the definition.
Couldn't it be
is for the same activity.
Couldn't it be also a possible to draft a law that says parking for ski area activities in the relevant ski area subzone is
exactly.
X?
Yes.
That wouldn't that be simple?
It would be.
Because, say you start from the premise that parking isn't permitted as part of ski area activities. So say it isn't, because we can't deal with that anyway.
No.
Isn't that the solution as opposed to just exempting?
It is another good alternative. Yes,
but
yes.
Right.
Yeah. From a parking point of view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And outside of the ski area.
Yeah, when we get to outside of the ski area subzones, isn't it really a matter of what zone it's going to occur in, rather than the fact that it's outside? I mean, it's not axiomatic that it's going to be in the rural zone, so.
Sorry.
Well, there are five ski area subzones in the district.
Mm-hmm.
In Trimalcombe, well, in any of them, you could actually have off-site parking in the urban areas.
Very
odd.
I hadn't thought of that. Yes.
Yes.
With a parking right facility.
With a parking right facility.
Yeah. Like Cadrona, for example.
It could be within the Cadrona village. It could equally be in Wanaka to serve Cadrona and Trimalcombe and the snowfall. There is already an operation running from the centre of Queenstown to the ski fields. So it's not axiomatic that off-site parking is going to be in the rural zone, is it?
No, and I haven't considered that.
And so really it's a matter of what zone it's going to be in, should be the determining what consent classification it is, given that certainly in the nearby parts of the rural zone, respective, all of the ski area subzones, they're outstanding natural landscapes, aren't they?
Mr.
Ferguson's been the place to answer that. I thought almost exclusively
that would
be.
Yes.
And might.
I think the bottom of the Remarkables on the other side of the State Highway.
Yes.
And the entire Cadrona Valley is in our.
Oh.
Yeah, and the entire Matapitoki. So it's probably the only bit is the bottom of the Remarkables.
Right. It's right. Right. Yeah.
Yes. And perhaps a bit of Arthur's point close to people. That's outside the rules anymore. Really, right?
And I mean, given that parking not associated with an activity on the site, which is what we're talking about here, could occur in any zone, would 29.4.11, which is the default for all parking that's not otherwise listed in Table 29.5 as a full discretionary, would that be an appropriate default for parking not within the ski area subzone?
Okay, so
it could say parking for any activity not listed in the table discretionary, apart from in the ski area subzone, permitted.
Well, you could include it in the table.
Yeah, well, I think that would be cleaner as an entry that provides for
that some mechanism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other factor, which I'm trying to work through in my mind, is that ratio that we just talked about off-site accessory parking for the ski area subzones that may occur in any zone as a parking right type facility, and the extent to which that's related to the
Jones is recommending some amendment
to the definition, I think, of off-site parking to exclude parking associated with ski activities. So I'd probably want some time to look at in this light of this discussion, the implications of that.
Alright, perhaps you can think about how that might all come together.
If you need time to provide us with supplementary evidence, we need it by 4 p.m. Thursday.
Okay, I can certainly do that.
And my other question is, it's probably related to the same matter, but I'm going to find it hard to understand, is, and tell me why you think, what's the root reason for needing this additional policy about the functional dependency of ski area activities on transportation infrastructure?
Well, namely, the transport chapter in particular is silent on the characteristics of ski areas sometimes, and their interrelationship with transportation issues. And it generally reads as having quite an urban flavour. And I think, as Ms. Baker-Galloway pointed out earlier, that ski area activities do generate a lot of traffic and interest, and but are also of importance from a recreational and economic perspective to the district. So I think in terms of if amendments are going to be made to the provisions to recognise those, the transportation effects that need to be managed by and are generated by ski area activities, then it would, to my mind, be appropriate to have a policy framework that reflects that approach. But in light of what we've discussed this morning, it might be that that policy also needs to be looked at in light of that discussion.
So what sort of applications in terms of what Chapter 29 provides for or might provide for would require a policy to be thought about and reconsidered in that application?
Well, for example, if as the chapter stands as attached to the rebuttal evidence of Ms. Jones, if the discretionary activity were brought into play for any parking that was provided for ski area activity, then there would be arguably not much in the policy framework that would enable consideration of that discretionary activity.
Right.
For that.
So like a new car park at the bottom of a ski field road, for example, where park and ride's going to operate from, or even a gondola. You're saying there's no policy that would, in the transport chapter, that would provide some indication of why such a proposal might be beneficial or have a link to the ski field activity itself.
There's obviously objectives and policies generally that talk about how the network should be managed. Policy 29.221D, for example, speaks to activities being required to provide sufficient parking in order to meet the parking demand in areas that are not well connected by public or active transport networks and are not identified in any council active or public transport network plans. Now, I haven't done the analysis to see whether and to what extent the council proposes to provide any public transport connections to the ski area activities, or either whether the operators themselves have any plans to expand any existing provision of that service. But I think that they have quite a unique locational characteristic, which tends to mean that people do rely on private vehicles to get there, whether that's going to always be the case or is appropriate. Sorry, I'm not making much sense. But yes, I think I need to look at that policy.
Yes, but maybe as part of looking at the rule package in Chapter 29.
Just going back to the ski area activities, I'm wondering whether the solution would be on Table 29.5. You might have to think about this and find your supplementary to do, but we have a list of community activities, and perhaps ski area activities within a ski area subzone should be listed as one of those community activities.
Then we could sort of say how many parks that should provide.
And have no parking requirement. That is the answer. There is no... Because the parking, there's no need for the council to say how many car parks they provide for those activities, but the operators will provide enough. And in fact, in some of the ski areas, council probably wouldn't encourage the development of further areas anyway.
So just so
the provision for passenger lift systems is actually designed to replace the parking within the ski area subzone. So there would be value in having that as a no requirement for the vehicle within its located within the ski area subzone. So it would be consistent with the other provisions.
So just just want to make sure we've got that clear. So it's table 29.5 and the potential of inserting a specific entry for ski area activities.
Yes.
Just basically saying that there was no
And then that would overcome that non-compliant activity problem because it will be listed in the table.
Mm. And that would be permitted subject to complying with, unless it's on or off-site, but be permitted activity subject to complying with the design and location aspects elsewhere in the chapter.
Yeah, other provisions. Yeah. But that, of course, there are other activities in the ski area subzones which are subject to these provisions anyway,
mm.
such as the sale of food and beverages and accommodation on the ski fields that have accommodation. So there are other provisions that apply in addition to the ski area activities themselves.
I think that's important.
I've also prepared a brief summary statement of my evidence and just read through that. Following the preparation of my evidence in chief, I reviewed the statements of rebuttal evidence prepared by Mr. Jerome Wythe for the Queensland Lakes District Council and the statements of evidence of other submitters that relate to Chapter 25, in particular Mr. Sean Dean for NZ Ski Limited and Mr. Farrell for Real Journeys Limited. The rebuttal evidence of the council reiterates its support for earthworks and ski area subzones to be subject to the Table 3 standards, particularly standards 25.5.12 to 14 and 25.2.20 and 25.2.21. I agree with Mr. Dean to Mr. Farrell that there's considerable overlap in the provisions of Table 3, particularly in relation to sediment discharge, which is 25.2.12, setbacks from waterways, 25.2.20, and groundwater, 25.2.21, and the regional plan water. While I do not disagree with the position of council that the RLA provides authority for this duplication to occur, I am of the view that such duplication does contain some inherent inefficiencies. The environmental benefits meriting the costs associated with these inefficiencies should therefore be clearly established. The rebuttal evidence of Mr. Wythe refers to proposed rules representing best practice based on the application of the Auckland Unitary Plan. However, no evidence has been provided explaining why the earthworks volumes or setback requirements for the Auckland region are directly applicable to the environmental conditions of the Queensland Lakes District, or why they constitute best practice in the planning sense. Mr. Dent advances the view that the exemptions for activities in ski area subzones from the earthworks rules should be made on the basis of the land tenure due to a greater certainty provided by the concessions process on public conservation land. In his rebuttal evidence, Mr. Wythe indicates he disagrees with this position, as is the view that the existing regulation does not provide sufficient certainty to extend the exemption to earthworks rules in ski area subzones. In my experience, there's actually a high level of ongoing regulatory involvement by the Otago Regional Council in relation to activities within ski area subzones due to the number of consents required by these activities. I consider this oversight provides greater certainty to the community that the environmental effects of earthworks are being appropriately managed than can be provided by the permitted activity regime proposed. And I do not agree with the position of Mr. Dent that the concession process for Crown land provides greater certainty to merit a different approach to regulation of activities within ski area subzones than occurs under other tenure. In relation to the general application of standard 25.520, I would agree with the position of Mr. Farrell that a 10 metre setback from waterways is very large, and in the absence of evidence to advance my understanding further, I remain of the view that the existing thresholds of 7 metres distance from a water body and 20 cubic metre volume of earthworks is more appropriate. I consider that despite the changes proposed by Mr. Wythe, the intent of standard 25.521 remains unclear, and the broader definitions of aquifer include rock or gravel containing water could result in this rule being breached more widely than is, appears anticipated. This may be particularly relevant in the skier subzones, where aquifers in the broad sense are uncommon, but groundwater may be frequently exposed due to proximity of bedrock to the surface.
Just firstly, looking at the policy, additional policy support that you think is necessary for earthworks within the ski area subzones, can you look at policy 2251B?
Yes.
That's right. Yes, which talks about, so this is in the two objectives. There's an objective related to managing the effects of earthworks and minimising adverse effects, and then there's a second objective about the benefits of earthworks, and it's, I mean, the objective is specifically about the benefits of earthworks, which is what you're concerned about in terms of the ski areas. And then the new policy says enable earthworks that are necessary to provide for people and communities' well-being, having particular regard to the importance of tourism infrastructure and activities, including the continued operation and provision for future sensitive development of recreation and tourism areas, activities within the ski area subzone. So why is that not enough?
I think that does substantially help the position in terms of earthworks relation to ski area subzones. And the submitters sought in the ski area subzones, I guess, a greater recognition of the need, the broader need for activities that occurred there. And that was not addressed at that time. And I think in part it relates to, as Commissioner Nixon was alluding to earlier, concerns relating to the king salmon, balancing of policies between restrictive policies and enabling policies to make sure that development can occur when that balancing needs to be considered. And Mr. White has, you know, made an attempt to balance that effect through the earthworks section. I mean, it doesn't address the wider policy structure in relation to activities occurring there, but it does help address that specifically related to earthworks, and I understand that's what this chapter has to focus on. So it's partially addressing that overall desire that the submitter has, that, you know, the balance of activities can be considered against an enabling structure.
It's the most positive statement about any activity, really,
yes, yep,
to do with earth and that benefits of earthworks.
Yes.
It's the only sort of some activity that's singled out.
Yes.
Do you read that as providing quite a signal?
Yes, I do.
That earthworks are important,
yes,
for ski areas.
Yes, I think the amendment is very helpful for us.
Well, it's not amended at all. It's obviously what was there from the start. I mean, apart from the taking out the word subject to objective 25.2.1, which I think,
yes, that was
an important change.
Well, that was an important change for us because it made it, with that subject to, it made it feel that the other policy had priority.
Yes. But without that subject to,
yes,
it's now just a direct policy supporting groups, recognising the importance of earthworks and
skin
to the
community.
All right. I'm intrigued about your reference to Chapter 33, the Clearance of Vegetation Rules, and how they get triggered by earthworks, I presume, and may get triggered by earthworks in the ski area subzones. When I look at that chapter, it seems to me that it's very focused, if not solely focused, on biodiversity and indigenous vegetation values, and the sorts of matters that are being controlled by this earthworks chapter: sediment discharge to waterways, dust nuisance, are not covered at all. Are you able to say why you think that it's relevant, Chapter 33, to this earthworks matter?
I think it's probably been addressed in the changes that have been made to the structure by Mr. White anyway, so it's probably less relevant and balanced, but I guess it was initially thought that because you couldn't really, it was very difficult to clear earthwork, unclear vegetation and ski area subsides without actually undertaking earthworks, it would have been worthwhile doing both activities as one. But as the chapters have been separated and it's understood that the earthworks is supposed to be a standalone chapter, it is difficult to see how that's going to be resolved in the current structure, so we wouldn't get that stand.
All right. And now, when you heard our exchange with Ms. Baker Galloway about the ORC provisions, because we had quite other people come and talk to us about them. Mm-hmm. And so, first of all, looking at, you agree there's no land plan?
Oh, absolutely, yes, there's no land plan, yes.
And that the water plan, which you refer to, is about discharges to waterways, on the one hand, also activities in waterways, I'll put that to one side, I'm just talking about the discharges. So how can that the rule in the ORC water plan that relates to discharges to waterways be effective in ensuring that land uses are undertaken in a way that can never allow that standard to be breached? Do we want to be waiting for there to be a discharge for ORC to come in and say have enforcement action or something?
No, it's a privileged activity to undertake activities which do not mitigate sediment of discharge into the waterways, which in theory requires a developer or someone undertaking the activity to put the works in place.
Is that actually true? Is it a permitted activity to undertake activities that do not result in discharge, or is it just a permitted activity not to discharge?
No, sorry, it's a prohibited activity not to put in place measures to control sediment discharge into streams under the regional plan of water. I guess a similar situation occurs in terms of what's proposed by council is it's a permitted activity provided that appropriate measures are undertaken. And so it's not a dissimilar situation anyways, because there's no fundamental requirement for a developer to put it in place. It's only going to be measured in the breach, which is exactly the same situation effectively with the regional council.
Does the regional council, who doesn't have a land use focus, has a water focus? I mean, to what extent would they ever go around looking at land use activities and looking at the management of those activities, sort of hoping, with the thought of ensuring that they won't end up with a non-consented discharge?
My point is that the permitted activity is effectively the same. Is the council is not actually going out there to make sure council is not going to make sure that an activity is being undertaken which is permitted without breaching it, because they won't. The activity is permitted, so they'll be aware where it's occurred. Similarly, the ORC has a prohibited activity status applying. Retrospectively, if you fail it, then you need to give a consent, and effectively, councils are establishing the same regime. If you do cause a discharge, then you'll need to get a consent to manage the fact you've caused a discharge. It's not requiring consent in the first place that will enable the steps to be put in place to manage that.
But this, at least the district plan has quite specific standards there which are pointing to the types of actions that need to be taken. And they may not be written. There may be ways they can be improved in the way they're written, but they are going through the different actions relating to discharge of sediment movement off-site, dust nuisance, actions near waterways, which are relating to land use or subdivision, and are pointing the landowner in the specific direction that they need to go in order to be a permitted activity. Whereas at the discharge end, it's way down the end of the pipeline sort of before the problem arises, before the ORC gets involved. is there not some more do you not see there's some more direct involvement at a district level versus a regional level under these?
Yes, I see what you're driving at. There is something in the plan which, you know, would indicate that these are things that you should apply. And the Solicitor hasn't opposed the rules per se, only in application to certain areas.
And are you saying that those rules are irrelevant for ski area subzones? Or that the ORC covers them off adequately?
Well, in my experience, the Regional Council has actually a high level of involvement in ski area subzones. Surprisingly for many people, because the nature of ski area subzones is they are elevated locations and they're putting together quite a mix of activities, so they require quite extensive consensus from Regional Council in terms of water takes, discharges, and in terms of discharges to land or effluent and so forth, and often involves works in proximity to waterways due to crossings of wetlands or rivers. So there is actually quite a high level of regulatory involvement by the Regional Council, which is much more so than the other activities in the district.
But isn't that involvement particularly focused on those regional activities that require consent, such as water crossings and water takes and discharges of sewage effluent, etc., rather than the wider land use, which they're not involved with?
Definitely, no, it's not focused on the wider land use or wider earthworks, but it's focused on the quality of water in the streams and so forth, or potential effects directly around them.
Ms. Galloway, Baker Galloway, talks about, in her legal submissions, referred to these snowmaking water pond problem. Do you cover that in your evidence? And then finally to the concession and the level of oversight that, say, DOC or LIMS, depending on who the lessee or concession manager is. We've been provided with some copies of some concessions by Mr. Dent. Certainly they're under acts that have a somewhat different focus than water quality. What's your view about the level of oversight that the Department of Conservation or LIMS has within the ski areas of subzones vis-a-vis ORC, vis-a-vis the District Council?
Well, I mean, it's different in many ways because, as you say, they work under a different act, and so they focus on some specific different areas. And so I think they probably provide a more direct oversight on particular aspects of the earthworks. And from, you know, Mr. Henson, they're through the process of the earthworks, you know, quite a lot. So they provide, you know, far more oversight in terms of the impacts on indigenous vegetation and so forth, and you know, the shaping of them and the reshaping of them in terms of landform, where those are matters of interest. They possibly have a less frequent ongoing involvement than the OIC does due to the requirements for compliance monitoring with the various different consents that the OIC has. So I think that OIC compliance officers are there, you know, a number of times during the year because of the range of different consents they have to visit. So theirs is more specifically focused around the earthworks where they're occurring. The OIC is probably more ongoing involvement.
It seems that the concession requirements are very much focused on the ecological values, whether they're indigenous vegetation or potentially ecological values within waterways. I come back for ORC, you keep saying they're there because of the consents that are required. And so am I understanding from you that ORC's involvement is very much around those activities that require consents from the ORC?
Yes.
Only one question, really. You may recall Mr. Galloway, the issue of the question about do the ORC planning instruments specify, as do the ECAN ones in Canterbury, what the role of the District Council is with matters such as land use, earthworks and such like? Are you aware that any of those documents specify what the role of the District
I'm not completely okay with it, with the current format of the latest version of the appeals version of the proposed regional policy statement. I did work on it up until the notification stage, and at that point it did not really clearly set out the different functions of the regional council and the territorial authorities to the extent that the Canterbury Regional Plan did. It was one of the things that we thought would be worth achieving, because I think the situation in Otago was more uncertain than Canterbury because of the lack of a land plan. But it was not one of the things that was finally adopted into the regional policy statement to the extent that the Canterbury plan is definitely, because the Canterbury plan had a number, it had a chapter format, and each chapter kind of identified quite clearly the different roles of the regional council versus the territorial authorities. And I thought that was a very good format in terms of clarifying those issues. And the Otago regional policy statement did not at that stage provide that level of clarity. I'd have to check the current version, and I'm happy to do so.
Can I interrupt you? Because I thought I recall Mr. Wyeth covering that in his Section 42A report, and he does. Paragraph 426 of his original evidence covers the proposed Otago Regional Policy Statement, where there's a method for district and city plans relating to soil erosion and relating to the policies relating to soils, and which requires them to include provisions to manage the discharge of dust and silt and sediment associated with earthworks and land use. So in his view, it places an obligation on territorial authorities to manage the potential effects of erosion and sedimentation from land use activities. And given that OIC don't have a dedicated land plan, the proposed RPS purposefully directs those activities to district councils, and appropriately from his point of view. You're not familiar with that provision at all?
I don't have that currently at the moment. At one point, at the last point I was aware, there was a degree of overlap, which was not dissimilar to the overlap in the RMA between the two functions of the councils, and at that point, as far as I'm aware, that it still had not clarified the relationship, so unfortunately it was still no further ahead than the actual provisions of the Act in terms of saying, okay, we have reached an agreement between territorial authorities that we will deal with these functions and you will deal with those, but I will check that.
Yes, but I think you said you agree that it's within the functions of a district council, and it's within.
Oh, yes, I don't disagree.
And it's therefore within the ability of an RPS to direct those functions to be carried out.
Yes, yep.
By a district council.
Yes,
yep. Thank you.
I guess our submissions on the context were on the provisions relating to dust and sediment discharges to water and so forth. Council has actually recognised that the ski area subzones are relatively special in terms of the benefits they provide to the district, and has actually exempted the ski area subzones from the substantial earthworks rules relating to volume and area. So council's actually recognising the fact that there is a cost to having the ski areas, and that is that some of the impacts are actually clear beyond the boundaries of the zone. And I guess that was one of the points we were making and distinguishing, is that clearly some of these effects are visible beyond the zone, and it's a fact. It's not that they are all internalised within the zones at all. Landscape is clearly one of the most significant of those. So it seems to be a fundamental of the ski area subzone. It's pretty hard to miss them really when you're in the district. It's driving around. So there has been an evaluation that these have such a benefit that these costs to the environment are actually acceptable to the community, and it doesn't seem to, those provisions don't seem to be greatly disputed.
And how would you view that, given the changing environment of ski areas, in that they're becoming more of an all-round resort, so impacts could be more year-round, more readily visible, more readily?
I'm not sure whether they'll be more readily visible. I guess it really depends on the nature of the activities that occur, and that's a significant uncertainty to us. You know, I think there's a lot of benefit in other activities occurring in ski area subzones during the summer, so that, you know, the area that has been modified is actually being used in multiple ways, and so, you know, you're actually getting greater benefits. And some of the activities that have been proposed in the past is, you know, activities such as mountain biking and so forth, and then the commercial activities associated with those, which weren't directly related to skiing, and so that would seem to be one of the trade-offs. And then there's, you know, obviously things like paragliding and a range of other activities which are trying to make use of the same facilities which are in place, such as chairlifts and so forth. When you start kind of going beyond that, it's kind of hard to know exactly what the nature of the activities we're talking about are. And so we're really focusing on what are the earthworks that are associated with those. And so most of the earthworks associated with those are actually covered by the exemptions in terms of scale, the volumes, and the cuts, and so forth. And they're accepted by council as being considered appropriate. The areas we're focused on, and I fully acknowledge that the changes council's made to some of the standards, such as, you know, the dust discharges and the discharges to roads and so forth, are quite beneficial, and the change to status from non-compliant to restricted discretion is also beneficial. But on the whole, you know, those are the areas we've focused our submissions on.
Yeah. I was just interested because traditionally, the impacts of earthworks, sedimentation, the dust would be under a layer of snow. So therefore, they're not as in your face as if it's in the middle of summer, when there's no layer of snow to cover up earthworks, the dust gets into the river, etc., etc.
It occurs every year. You know, the ski area is exposed. The earthworks, I guess, we're focusing on really is the activity of undertaking them at a particular point of time. So the landscape modifications of the earthworks, you're right, you know, they're very visible in summer. And I guess that's the point I was alluding to. You know, council seems to have accepted, okay, well, to enable these activities to occur at ski fields, then we must accept some degree of landscape modification as being appropriate. And it's accepting them, you know, year-round, summer and winter. But actually undertaking more earthworks, which is really what's going to trigger most of the controls we're relating to, you know, that's when generally more likely occur in summer. So, you know, it's a very brief window, and that's operationally one of the key concerns that the ski field companies have. They have a very short time to undertake the works that they need to do because of the environmental considerations. And so that's a pretty significant constraint they have.
And you made a point about council needing to produce evidence that represents or defines best practice. In your opinion, would you consider the current regime best practice, or in the Queensland lens, or could it be improved upon?
There's best practice could be applied in two contexts. One is to how the earthworks are undertaken, which is more a kind of a management type regime, and the other is a best practice kind of planning regime. Are these rules considered most appropriate, and why, and what's the structure that's considered most necessary? And so, I'm not qualified to speak on the nature of the engineering, you know, practice of the earthworks, and I note that, you know, Mr. Sunich did some work on that, and in 2012, you know, work was done on that, and they both times, you know, they indicated, well, there are improvements that could be made in terms of how earthworks are managed in the district. And by and large, those assessments were done of actual consented activities. And so it's not a matter of saying, well, there's no control over these activities, it's more that there is control over them, but they could be done better to manage the effects of the earthworks site. In terms of the planning regime, I was saying, well, there's no evidence that this is a best practice result, because there was no document saying, okay, well, we've looked at a range of different planning rules and regulations, and we consider these, to be the most appropriate to meet the effects, such as might be done by, you know, New Zealand Planning Institute or Quality Planning or something, where they amalgamate a number of different documents and say, well, this is why we consider these rules, these policies, to have, you know, the most effective, most great, the greatest effect or most appropriate, you know, balancing of effects. And that's, you know, council alluded there being somewhat of best practice to it. And my point was simply that the only planning document they quoted that was adopting these figures was the Auckland Unitary Plan. And that doesn't necessarily mean that is an example of best practice, it's an example of practice, but whether that's most appropriate in terms of the Queenstown Lakes District is not really established.
Just following on from that, though, given the topography of this district, it's unlikely that any standards that would be appropriate would be more liberal than those in the Auckland area, wouldn't it?
I'm not necessarily sure. I mean, it's a mix of topography versus, you know, intensity of rainfall. Obviously, intensity of rainfall was one of the key things in terms of the effects of discharge and the risk of occurring. You know, we have significantly different rainfall patterns than Auckland.
Mr. Summers told us that he had actually made all the adjustments taking account of those factors and the different nature of the geology.
He's provided a hypothetical model of what he considers appropriate to the district, but then it's not really an evidence base, it's a model, and if that is the case, then we should be able to see some evidence of the discharges occurring to streams around us, and this, you know, we should have access to, you know, well, there is access to available information on water monitoring. You know, water monitoring is undertaken in Queenstown Lakes District. There's a compliance undertaken by both Queenstown Lakes District Council and the Otago Regional Council, and, you know, those are three means of providing evidence to indicate, well, is there a high level of sediment being discharged into our waterways that has not occurred in the past? We're getting a lot of compliance issues raised by either of those councils, and they will provide some form of evidence to support these, particularly if we've had a plan change in the last 2 years to indicate a change in status.
To be fair to Mr. Sunup, just innocent, he did provide photos attached to the evidence provided. They did not relate to ski area subzones, but they did relate to discharges occurring within the district.
He did,
certainly. Certainly did not appear to be satisfactory discharges occurring within the district, just on the face of it.
He provided some examples of, and they were consented activities that were causing discharges.
Under the operative provisions, which he contended, suggested that there was a problem with the operative provisions. Do you disagree with that contention?
Well, I guess one of my concerns would be that is there a difference between the operative provision saying that you, if it's a matter of control, earthworks are a matter of control, and so therefore they're conditioned. And so you are putting in place conditions saying you will manage earthworks by a range of different management techniques. That's usually how earthworks are managed, to my experience, isn't it? There's a standard that requires a consent. The consent requires conditions to be put in place, and that is how the earthworks are managed in practice. And most of the time, it's obviously one of the complexities with managing earthworks is that it can't occur in a fixed time. It has to be an adjusted process because the environmental conditions change, don't they? So dust in particular is a classic example. You know, you get increased winds or increased dryness, and the application of water needs to occur more frequently, or else, you know, you get a greater chance of having dust discharges. And the same can occur in terms of rainfall. So he showed examples of places where, you know, clearly consents had occurred and practices had been put in place, and they proved to be adequate. It doesn't indicate that they couldn't have been controlled through the standards and better conditions put in place or better management practices put in place. And so I guess that's the point I'm distinguishing between. Is the actual regulatory regime already in place adequate? It's just the controls that have been put in place through the conditions or the ongoing management, the rate of management wasn't adequate, and that's what caused those discharges.
We'll adjourn 10 minutes before we hear from Mr. Ferguson. We have enough time for that.
Sorry? You'd like to carry on?
No,
we want to
adjourn 10
good.
Minutes. Yes, and we have enough time to hear Mr. Ferguson.